about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukraine conflict, there have been some major gains made by the Russian army, unlike what is being reported by the Western media. For example, the port city of Mariupol is now under full Russian control. This is while the Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky has said only diplomacy can end the war, unlike its partners like the U.S., who just got the green light for another $40 billion in military aid. Meanwhile, the world is suffering from food shortages and record inflation. Well, these are just some of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Political analyst and blogger at The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, joins us from New York. Also joining us is political analyst Rusia Segodnya from Rustam Safronov, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the military advancements that has been made by Russia. Basically, the siege of the Azovstal is over, and it is reported that Russia is in full control of Mariupol. First of all, why is that deemed to be Russia's biggest victory yet, as it has been described?
Mariupol was the strongest redoubt of the Azov battalion, who were the most dedicated and vicious fighters on behalf of the Kiev government. And there was an enormous number of fighters that were taken prisoner. I think it was almost 2,500 came out over the past few days and surrendered unconditionally to the Donbas and Russian troops. And that was a surrender, not an evacuation, as the American press presented it. So it demonstrates that, you know, it took a long time. It took longer than maybe that Russians wanted or thought it would, but the Russians worked methodically for that victory, and it's a big victory, and it's going.
Okay, it seems like we may have lost our guest there. Rustam, let me ask you about how this gives Russia the advantage that it was looking for, and not only that, looking at the way that this at this point may then lead Russia to move into the Donbas region as a whole. I'm guessing that is the next military maneuver or strategy that Russia has. And if so, if it does take over Donbas, does that give an indication that perhaps the war is going to be over? I mean, is that Russia's military objective in this war?
Well, I think it's a minimum what Russia wants to get. That's liberation of Donbas from Ukrainian control and giving how Russia would present that the people of Donbass right to decide their destiny. Do they want to be independent or to be with Russia? But certainly not under Kiev control. Would Russia go further and continue advancing to another areas of Ukraine, trying to occupy, for example, entire coast of the Black Sea? That remains to be seen. The question is the position of Kiev government. They do not want to give up. They do not recognize Russian rights to control the destiny of Donbass and even don't want to give up in Crimea. All of that making truce in next future impossible. What Mariupol meant, that's a big chunk of military force what Ukraine has, finally was substantially tarnished, diminished, because that's so-called die-hard, almost like Ukrainian SS fighters, which used to not supposed to surrender and whatever. They used to be glorified, very dedicated, very much brainwashed with a semi-nationalistic, almost Nazi propaganda. Finally, they have to give up. And it's giving Russia some moral advantage. Okay. I mean, military too, because defense of Azovstal plant was a huge military event and siege of that. And it was distract a lot of Russian forces from advancing to entire area of Donbass. They used to be paralyzed there because, you know, tied up, tangled up. So now it's over, and it will help to liberate some forces for further advances. So that's how I'm seeing the situation.
So that's one way of looking at it, Jim Kavanaugh. But the other way that mainly Western media is depicting this, and we're trying to just get to the bottom of what's going on militarily, is that this war has been, or special military operation has been a failure when it comes to Russia. We know, and I'm sure you're familiar with how it's been described as what was supposed to be a lightning conquest, as it's been written, but yet it's been somewhat drawn out, and Russia has been unable to take the capital, Kyiv, seen as a failure and a pullback of forces. But based on what we're seeing today, I mean, that's not a military failure on the part of Russia. Are the online, whether online or any other description of Russia failing military, just meant to hamper and disappoint the Russian morale, so to speak?
Well, it's meant to gin up support in the West and in the United States for a fight that they believe they can win. We have, I think it's the case, and I don't think, you know, I don't want to pretend not to recognize that the things didn't go as quickly as Russia probably thought they would, and that many people who were supporters of the Russian cause here thought it would. But I think that, you know, when you look at the real deep military situation, the Russians are achieving their objectives. And the primary objective wasn't to, the defeat of an enemy doesn't happen because you take cities, it happens because you destroy their military. And this is what the Russians have been methodically doing, destroying the Ukrainian military apparatus from its logistics and its ability to resupply and its communications possibilities, etc. And the Russians really want to secure the Donbass republics. They want to secure the coast, and they've been largely successful on that. So the thing that's been happening in the United States and is the West is, you know, tactical retreats, changes of position, movements of have been portrayed as Russia's losing. And that has encouraged a lot of people to say, we have to fight, and American politicians, we can fight this to win it, and not only to help Ukraine, but to weaken Russia. I think that's a fantasy and a very dangerous one that is getting us into a very close to a third world war.
All right, now comes one of the key questions that I'm hoping that you can answer, Rustam, and that is how it has been reported that the Azov fighters, of which it has been described to be far right, and perhaps you can expand on that more for us, is said to have had an impact or an effect in this conflict. Please tell us about the Azov fighters, who they are, what does their capture mean, how many numbers there are, and whether one of the main reasons that Putin went into this special military operation was, as he said, to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. This has been talked about, but now that they have been captured, many of them, tell us what it means in terms of the war.
Well, it used to be a few thousands of fighters of Azov, very elite and very well trained and equipped, not even a detachment, it's almost brigade. So because it was increasing and recruiting new members, and it was very prestigious to serve in that detachment. that were highly motivated military men, volunteers, soldiers, convinced nationalists. A lot of them right now, when they used to be searched during the surrender, have in their body tattoo of the Hitler swastika, pictures of Stepan Bandera. One of those individuals, I think with the name of David Kasatkin or something like that, he had a sign additionally to everything else, to different kind of slogans and words and swastika. He had also sign, kill all of them. So it's like a soldier who was looking at him saying, like, who do you really want to kill? Like, who all, like, whatever, entire people in the face of the earth. So that was very motivated people. And generally speaking, in Ukrainian military forces after 2014, when Russia took over Crimea, new Ukrainian authorities put a lot of emphasis into the nationalistic spirit of Ukrainian army. First of all, they moved from the east all military schools to Lvov, to that area, to Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, to the west. And they inserted special political commissars from the western part of Ukraine, which is traditionally much more nationalistic, into military structure to be able to discipline and boost morale in nationalistic way. So Azov was a core of all of that. That's why Azov was defending biggest city in the area of Donbass, which rebellion republics wasn't able to conquer. So that's why the failure of Azov meant so much. I told you before, it's almost like SS used to be in Nazi Germany.
Right, Azov. Well, that's how it's been described. And Jim Kavanaugh, Ukraine is the world's only nation to actually have this neo-Nazi formation within its military ranks. And again, as our guests there talked about them, they are very capable to earn that. And that is perhaps why the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that they are the ones that are being targeted. But again, the picture that's being painted is not as such when you listen to Western media, that Putin's just out of his mind to even mention this, and that's just some kind of, I don't know, illusion or delusion that the Russian president has. What are your thoughts on the fact that now the arrest of and the death of some of these Azov fighters is a factor in this war?
Well, it is a factor. It's always been a factor. And but your point is valid. I don't know to the extent to which the West and Western media is willing to recognize this. I mean, the Azov battalion is one of a number of really fascistic battalions. And these are groups, the political groups that whose legacy goes back to fighting with Hitler in the Second World War. And they're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it. And they boast about it. And they call themselves Nazis. So, and you do have a relationship between, you know, the fascist groups around the world, especially in Europe, look to them, because as you say, this is the only nation in the world where these groups are highly integrated into the state apparatus and the military apparatus. And they've changed the ideological framework and climate of the country since 2014. So, you know, you have groups around the world that look to them for inspiration. The Buffalo shooter in New York, last week in New York, took his inspiration from the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, who took his inspiration from the Azov battalion, whom he visited in Ukraine. And you have the fact that if these groups win, that's going to be an impetus and it's going to be an inspiration to fascist groups around the world. And if they lose, that's going to be a defeat for them. So this is part of what's going on here, and it's an important part.
Yeah, and that's not a narrative that you're going to hear. What you just said is not something you're going to hear specifically in Western media. Okay, let's take a look at another development here, Rustam, and that is the fact that you're looking at Finland and Sweden and the membership to NATO. Now, the question I have is not just these two countries, but the way that they are going about becoming a member, the incentive behind it. Do you think that there is some kind of scaremongering tactics that perhaps the U.S. is using for countries, European countries like these two, that say, listen, if you don't join NATO, you could be next, something to that effect, in order not only to get weapon sales, but also obviously to have membership dues, because obviously we know they have to pay that to the NATO organization.
Well, you're right about that, absolutely. In one point, when president was Mr. Donald Trump, he used to argue all the time, Europe and this rich nation of Europe do not contribute enough in all these defense apparatus, security issues in Europe. They do not pay enough. Why only Americans have to carry that way, this weight? And all these leads would be useful for United States. But I wouldn't deny natural fear of that nations in general atmosphere, because we have to admit majority of so-called civilized world, Western world, they portray that action of Russia as an aggression, and conversations like narrative, oh, you're the next, it's very much spread around the people who want to be scared. I mean, like, for example, some nationalists in Central Asia saying, oh, Kazakhstan going to be the next, you know, let's like whatever, move further away from Russia. Like in European nations saying, oh, next thing like Putin will take over Baltic republics. Of course, all of that seems to me as a very big exaggeration, and Russia doesn't have energy or drive for that. With Ukraine, it was a different story. It was a combination of two factors. Yes, Russia, Kremlin are considering armament of Ukraine and attempt to join the NATO as an existential threat. But it was especially painful and dangerous because, yes, Mr. Putin and a lot of people in Russia thinking, we grow up from the one root, these three nations, Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. So they're almost the same. They're almost one people, not exactly, but almost. So, and for them especially, they drive to the West. That's a especially upsetting, treacherous thing, which has to be prevented by any cost. That's what contribute into that special military operation, mm-hmm. As a rationale, as a... Well, Finland and Sweden, Putin said, like, we don't really care about so much. I mean, it's bad, but we don't have anything against these nations, and we're not like, yes, we do. We will create necessary step, move troops, whatever, create different bases in the border, but it's not where we're seeing dangers from. You could see, like, Ukraine with Azov, with a very powerful nationalistic rhetoric, with a suppressing Russian-speaking population in Donbass seems being much more dangerous to Kremlin. That's okay. Why it's a different story.
All right. So here we have Zelensky. Aside from the fact that it watches as countries join NATO within a span of a very short period of time, and aside from the fact that the EU is not prepared to have membership for it, it says Zelensky is saying a diplomatic solution is still possible. Diplomacy is the only way to end the war. Well, that's fine and dandy, but then you have the U.S. got another $40 billion just approved, and you still have the push for a military solution to come not only from the U.S., but obviously it leading the pack of NATO countries, NATO member countries. What is the story there? Do you think Zelensky, Jim Kavanaugh, wants some kind of negotiations now? Or is he just saying that, and he has to follow whoever is ordering him?
I think that Zelensky is not in control of the situation, and I think that you'd have to be silly to not think that he's every day on the phone and zooming call with his handlers in Washington and the CIA and American embassy, and he's under pressure from the right-wing fascists in Ukraine who do not want to settle this with Russia. Look. There was a diplomatic situation. This is the whole point. there was a diplomatic situation that was arrived at 8 years ago, and he was elected as president a couple of years ago to implement it, and he couldn't do it. And the United States doesn't want the war to stop, and the right-wing fascists don't want a war to stop. And his own senior advisor is on the record. You can see it on the internet saying a war with Russia is the only way we're going to get into NATO. So there is it's very difficult, because the diplomatic solution, which is neutrality for Ukraine, no NATO, recognize Crimea as Russian and the Donbass republics as independent, is what Russia is after. And they're not going to stop. If they don't get that, they've lost. And if Ukraine gives that up, they have lost. This is quite clear. One side or the other of this is going to suffer a decisive defeat, and it cannot be hidden. And that's why, you know, this idea of a diplomatic solution is fine. There was one that could have worked, which would have kept the Donbass republics as autonomous regions within a unified Ukrainian state. That was destroyed by Ukraine.
All right, Rustam, looking at the goal that the U.S. has, as it has stated, even though we know that the real goal, which it has also stated, being that it wants Russia to be militarily defeated, but it also wants Russia to have total devastation economically. Now, it's pushing really hard for that. In some ways, it has been successful. But when you take a look at how the Russian ruble, for example, is now the world's top performing currency for the year 2022, up 11% against the dollar, and you're still looking at EU countries buying the oil, and there are even talks of other commodities being added to the payment in ruble scheme, such as wheat, maybe, and meat. Do you think that U.S. then is defeated in its intentions when it comes to the sanctions regime against Russia?
You know, United States is a very powerful country, and it has a lot of capacities still. I wouldn't say it's United States is defeated. They could just became a little more practical and stop these attempts totally destroy Russia by trying to draw more and more Russian Ukraine into that war. That would be maybe more practical solution. But so far, the idea of like Reagan did to make Russia as bleed as possible during the war, and finally to destroy Russia economically and maybe politically as well, because obviously if Russia would lose, that would be not only the end of the Mr. Putin, that would be the end of contemporary political structure in Russia, and it could encourage different process of disintegration of Russia and so on. So what everybody is terrified in Russia to lose, because it could stimulate the process like happened in 1991 with the destruction of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And so far we don't, I mean, like we see the first steps of American realism. For example, they refused to give some advanced weapons to Ukraine last time. Because they feel like it could be spread to the territory of Russian Federation, which already Ukraine trying to do. In this point, if Russia feels too desperate, it could use tactical nuclear weapon, and it could lead to world disaster, nuclear war. So I don't think United States are interested to have that sort of outcome.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Jim Kavanaugh from New York, the polemicist, political analyst and blogger, political analyst there at Russia Segodnya, Rustam Safronov from Moscow. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, meeting the needs of neighbors before requesting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of meeting the needs of neighbors before requesting. Now, it is ethical that we must know about the state of our neighbors and to meet the needs of them before they request for it. And this shows us that whoever performs such thing, he is a good neighbor and he is aware of his neighborhood. Whereas Islam has also emphasized on the rights of the neighbors and to take care of the neighbors. And it is said that we must take care of our neighbors as we take care of our own selves or our family. And to have a peaceful neighborhood, to develop a peaceful neighborhood. Now, one of the ethical things that is also recommended in the Islamic teachings is that when we look at our neighbors, when we are living at a place, we must be aware of our neighbors. We must socialize with our neighbors. We must meet our neighbors. And when we go and meet them, when we socialize with them, we are aware of their financial status, financial position. We are aware of the needs that they have. We are aware of the things that they need. Maybe the need that they have, it's something which is not monetary. For example, they need an advice in a specific matter. Or maybe they need an advice in the health issues. Maybe they need an advice which is related to the law. Maybe they need an advice for developing or making something. So they can have any kind of need. Maybe they need an advice in their studies if there are students next to us. So the needs can be of different ways, and we must have a relation with our neighbors so that we know that what they need, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the meeting the needs of the neighbors before requesting. We said that it is necessary to have a good relations with the neighbors so that we know that who they are, what they need. And we said that this need is not necessarily being the monetary need. It can be other things as well. And the example was, for example, if there are some students living next to us and they need help in their studies. And if we can do that, we should do that. We should help them. But the best thing, according to the Islamic teachings, is إِعْطَاءِ مَا يَجِبُ لَهُمْ قَبْلَ السُّؤَالِ, to give what they need before they request it, to provide this help before they ask you for the help. And if we can help them before they ask, before they request, this is the best thing. Maybe we indirectly do that. Maybe directly we ask them. There are two different ways. But the best thing is when we know that they're struggling or maybe in future they will need this specific thing, we beforehand can help them before they ask so they do not struggle in finding the answer of something. They do not struggle if there is a financial need. And if we know about that, maybe they need something and we can gift it to them in a way that they do not mind it. And they accept this gift. And tomorrow, when we know that they will have the need of this, with this gift, this need is being fulfilled. So therefore, it is recommended according to the Islamic teaching, and especially in the narrations we have that the ethical relation with the neighbors is that to meet the needs of our neighbors before they request for it. And this is the best thing that we can do, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard. Their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism," and some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member, it sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found Stingers and Javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of Javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine. Not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremists being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shut down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, The United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is frozen and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here, and while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their park 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution, or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here
most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen. How people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Jenny Miller, Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
In the limelight.
Roughly 17.3 million people in the United States, including nearly 4 million children, live within a half-mile radius of active oil and gas production, which puts them at increased risk of suffering severe health problems from toxic air pollution. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, Map Shows Over 17 Million People in U.S. Threatened by Toxic Fossil Fuel Pollution. Here's the story. roughly 17.3 million people in the United States, including nearly 4 million children, live within a half-made radius of active oil and gas production, which puts them at increased risk of suffering severe health problems from toxic air pollution. That's according to the Oil and Gas Threat Map, a geospatial analysis released recently by Earthworks, which collaborated with Frag Tracker Alliance to create a data visualization tool. The oil and gas threat map highlights the shockingly large numbers of Americans impacted by drilling pollution. Ranjana Bhandra, executive director of the environmental justice group Livable Arlington, said in a statement, adding, "Almost a million residents of my Texas county, about half of the population, live less than half a mile from oil and gas operations." The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, said Bhandra must act with great urgency to protect them by issuing and enforcing stringent rules to drastically reduce toxic pollution from existing drilling as we rapidly transition to clean energy and end new fracking. This is the only way to reduce health impacts for extraction communities and slow down the worst climate effects of fracking. Nationwide, about 213,000 square miles are under threat from more than 1.5 million oil and gas wells, compressors, and processors. The overall area of this health threat radius has grown larger than Texas, includes almost 12,500 schools, and is home to 4.7 million more people now than in 2017. Further evidence of the negative consequences of expanding domestic fossil fuel production. Citing a slew of peer-reviewed studies, Earthworks and Frag Tracker Alliance determined that a half-mile radius is a very conservative estimate of the area within which elevated levels of toxic pollution are seen and the distance within which health impacts have most clearly been correlated with the presence of oil and gas facilities. Dr. Ann C. Epstein, clinical associate professor at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, stressed that living in close proximity to oil and gas development is a threat to public health. Health research shows that the closer you live and the more you are exposed to oil and gas development, the higher your risk of exposure to toxic air pollution and the higher your risk of serious heart disease, respiratory disease, and leukemia, said Epstein, adding, seniors are more likely to die and babies are more likely to be born with congenital heart disease and with complications of pregnancy. As the analysis explains, what threatens the areas, people, and schools on the oil and gas threat map are toxic volatile organic compounds, VOCs, emitted alongside methane. Normally invisible, these toxics commonly include benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylene, the so-called BTEX chemicals. Using optical gas imaging cameras to make methane, a greenhouse gas at least 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide in the short term, and carcinogenic VOCs visible, Earthworks thermographers have recorded more than 1,700 videos of oil and gas production sites since 2014, including the following samples taken at facilities in the Front Range. The oil and gas industry is by far the largest source of methane emissions and toxic air pollution in the U.S. EPA has proposed new federal safeguards to reduce methane and other harmful pollutants from new and existing fossil fuel operations, but Earthworks and Frag Tracker Alliance describes them as flawed. Fortunately, the groups note they are not yet final, and EPA has explicitly said they will consider strengthening them. According to Earthworks, an